This episode is brought to you by the Michigan Cherry Committee. Learn about the wonderfully tart Montmorency cherry at choosecherries.com.
Hi, I'm Eli Sussman, chef and owner of Samisa Restaurant, and we're here in Charleston recording a special episode of The Line. My guest today is Alon Shaya. He was born in Bat Yam, just south of Tel Aviv, and he moved to Philadelphia as a very young child. He started cooking in New Orleans when he was just 23 and quickly made a name for himself there. He's been nominated for 5 James Beard Awards and was named Best Chef South Region while at Dominica in 2015, and Shaya won the James Beard Award for Best New Restaurant in 2016. He was selected as one of 50 people who are changing the South by Southern Living magazine in 2015 and one of the 50 most influential Jews in America by The Forward. He recently formed Pomegranate Hospitality with his wife, which operates Saba in New Orleans and Safta in Denver, located in the Source Hotel. And in March of 2018, he published his debut cookbook, Shaya, An Odyssey of Food, My Journey Back to Israel. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Eli. Glad to be here.
So I want to start by talking about the beginning of your life in Israel growing up, your grandmother, Matilda, and what type of influence that had. So she wasn't born in Israel, right?
No, she was born in Bulgaria, in Sofia, and so was my Saba, my grandfather. And they both immigrated from Sofia to Jaffa in 1948.
And so was she a cook? Is the name relevant beyond the fact that she's your grandmother and you love her?
Big time. Okay. Yeah. She was an amazing cook and really was the one that really helped me fall in love with food and make that my lifelong dream to be involved with.
And a lot of people, they sort of grew up at the knee of one of their grandparents or their mom or something in the kitchen. She was probably bringing a lot of those flavors of Bulgaria coupled with what was going on in that time in Israel, a lot of Middle Eastern spice blends. So what exactly does that, what is your Safta's cuisine feel like and smell like and taste like?
Yeah, well, the roasting peppers and eggplants over an open fire was really one of my most earliest memories of food. And that's for a dish that she makes that's called lutenitsa, which is a Bulgarian spread of like roasted peppers and eggplant and tomato and garlic and olive oil that's cooked down for a long time. And that lutenitsa was my earliest memory of food and helped me think that food was connected to happiness and connected to family being together. So that was the most important thing that she would cook for me. But she'd also make burekas stuffed with feta cheese, and she'd make stuffed cabbage and braise it down for hours on the stovetop. And she'd make incredible fish egg spread called ikra, and we'd eat that with different kinds of pickles. She even made labneh and would, you know, season that up with all different kinds of vegetables and olive oil. I really think back to my Safta's cooking as some of the happiest times of my childhood.
It seems fair that the inspiration around food was there immediately, that you have these fairly strong memories. Did your Safta's passion trickle down to either your mom or your dad? So your mom was born in Israel, your dad came from Romania where they met there. Did they catch the cooking bug at all, or did it just jump to you?
My mother did. Mm-hmm. My mother would always cook all of my Safta's recipes. And so you know, I left Israel when I was 4 years old, and my Saba and Safta stayed in Jaffa. And so my mom then was the one from the age of 5 through my childhood who was the one that was cooking for me. And she would cook all of my Safta's recipes, and she'd also make a lot of her own recipes as well. And I learned just as much from my mom as I did from my SAFTA.
So what brought your family to Philadelphia? You had said before we went on air that your dad had moved to Philly a couple years before the rest of your family, and then you and your sister and your mom joined. So what was the impetus for moving to America? And also, I know you were really young, but were you excited? Did you have a lot of trepidation about leaving Israel and going somewhere totally new?
Yeah, my father fought in the Yom Kippur War in 1973 and opened up a frame shop in Jaffa that didn't do very well. And so he was just kind of having a real string of traumatic experiences in Israel, bad luck, and was just not happy there. And he wanted to come to America and make a better life for himself and for the rest of our family. And so his goal from the time he got to Israel was eventually to move to America and start a fresh life out here. So in 1980, he did that. And he came to the Philadelphia area because my mother's sister, my Aunt Debbie, was living in the Philadelphia area. So we had a family connection there. And so when he moved here in 1980, he began working as like a laborer in machine shops, and was working in a thrift store, stocking shelves and organizing all of the different, you know, furniture and clothing and everything that was for sale. And in 1980, by the time 1982 came around, he'd finally like raised up enough money so that we could, my sister and my mother and I could immigrate to Philadelphia. And he would, you know, he had a car and he had an apartment ready to go. And so we moved here, and I was not, at 4 years old, I don't think I knew what was really going on. But I also remember it like not being a good transition. My mother ended up leaving my father about a year after that. So by 1983, my mother was raising my sister and I on her own. And it was definitely hard and definitely not a happy time in my life. When my grandfather and my grandmother would come and be with us, because during that time that, you know, my mother separated from my father, we had to get a new house. We moved kind of more into the suburbs, and my grandmother and my grandfather would come and spend a lot of time with us to like take care of my mom and make sure that we were going to get off to a good start. And those were the times that my SAFTA would cook, you know, and she'd spend all day in the kitchen cooking while my Saba was out helping, you know, going to the hardware store, helping fix things up around the house, helping my, like teaching my mom how to drive. She didn't know how to drive. And so I would gravitate towards the kitchen and cook with my SAFTA. And I just remember those moments feeling like things were somewhat normal, because they would spoil us when they came and they would take us out to eat Chinese food and they would bring chocolates in their suitcase. And I just remember those, being with my grandparents, being happy times.
Was there a feeling as you started to get old enough to realize and remember that you had not been born in the United States, and I don't know, maybe your mom, definitely your grandparents had accents. Was there a feeling that you were different than American kids that you went to school with? And if there was, or if even if there wasn't, were you kind of pushing to really assimilate and Americanize yourself?
Very much so. I mean, I changed the pronunciation of my name to Alon versus Alon. Mm-hmm. Because people would call me Alone, and it made me feel lonelier than I already felt. I didn't speak English when I first came to America, so going to school and not understanding the language and feeling like my language was different was very hard for me. I was ended up getting bullied a lot, and I remember doing my best to assimilate and to be like everyone else and to really push anything that had to do with Israel or my life prior to coming to America. I really worked hard to push that all away.
Was there Was there a time before you got into high school, which we'll talk about in a second, there were some fairly influential people there, where you felt like it might be easier to just leave the United States and move back to Israel, maybe with your grandparents? Or did that not really cross your mind? Like, was it like, let me push forward and try to become as American as possible? Or was there any inkling of like, maybe there's a way to just kind of leave this life that's not really making me happy here?
Never did that ever come to my mind. Mm-hmm. It was push forward, survive, and try to be bigger and meaner and angrier than everyone was towards me.
So when you get into high school, are you head down, focused on studies? Are you a bad student who's a troublemaker? Like, what is that vibe like? And then if you can talk about two people that stepped into your life and had a really strong impact on shaping your future.
Yeah, well, the majority of my childhood, really all of my childhood, I was very, very angry, again, like very embarrassed about that my skin tone was a different color, that my language wasn't as good as everyone else's. So I really acted out. And by the time I was in high school, I was selling drugs, doing all kinds of drugs, stealing cars, beating people up, getting beat up, getting into knife fights, getting kicked out of school, all of the above, and a lot more. And it was I didn't have like any kind of like guidance or consequence. My mom was working two jobs. She was, you know, always doing her best to keep a roof over our heads. And my dad, I would only see on the weekend for a day. And I would pretty much just get into a lot of trouble. And by the time I like made it somewhat through high school, my home economics teacher, I took a home economics class because I got to hold knives and be around girls and freshly baked cookies. And I thought that was
the trifecta.
I thought that was way better than like sitting in, you know, Spanish class.
Yeah.
So, I took home ec and know that like throughout my childhood, like cooking was always such a very big part of my life. I cooked a lot at home, from a very young age. And, by the time I was in high school, I already had a job at a bakery and at a butcher shop, you know, cleaning up and working the register and taking out trash and washing dishes. So in high school, I took home ec, and Donna Barnett was my home economics teacher. And she, I respected her right away because she was no nonsense. She knew how to cook really well, and she really like held everyone's respect in the classroom. Everyone really enjoyed Donna's class because of her personality, and she was down to earth. And so, you know, Donna saw that I liked to cook and had a talent for it. And she was the one that really kind of helped me set my life straight. When other teachers would kick me out of her class, out of their class, they would send me to her class, and she worked out a deal with all the teachers in the school that Alan doesn't go to detention or doesn't get sent home. He comes to my classroom, and I'd go there, and she'd have like a big bag of onions and give me a knife and have me slice the onions. And I'd sit there like crying from slicing the onions, and she would start getting into my head and asking me what I did and why I did it and where I wanted to go and what I wanted to do. And she was the only adult in my childhood that I had any type that had any kind of authoritative influence on me. So she is the one that set me up to go to vocational school, which was a school about 20 minutes away from my high school. And by my senior year, I was going to Votech in the morning and cooking in a commercial style kitchen. And then I was coming back to my high school to take her home economics class, as well as all the other core classes. And she set me up at a job in a restaurant in Manayunk, Pennsylvania, which is a part of Philly. And so that was my first job in a fine dining restaurant, actually cooking, like working a station, when I was about 16 and a half years old. And at that point, my life started to turn around. And I began, you know, spending my time cooking and thinking about food and listening to Donna than I did being out on the streets, like doing all kinds of crazy,
she really saved
crazy
you.
Shit. She saved my life, no doubt about it. And so my vocational chef instructor, his name is Seth Schramm, him and Donna got together and really became my like representatives. Like they were the ones that would talk to my mom, tell her what I was doing every day, what I was going to be doing to try to get into culinary school. Seth wrote a letter of recommendation to the CIA because he was an alum from there, helped me find grants and scholarships to be able to afford to go. And together, Seth and Donna set me on the path to the Culinary Institute of America.
I know that you're still close with them, and we'll talk a little bit later on in the show about the projects and initiatives that you've started with them. But since you are still close with them, I wonder if you've ever asked them, what did they see in you that they thought would make you shapeable and be able to change? You've just told us so many things that made you appear from outward appearances like you're someone who didn't want help, didn't want saving, and sort of like a lost cause. And then here's two people that invested clearly a lot of time and energy in helping you. So what did they see? What do you think they saw when you were 16, 17?
Well, because I had a huge passion for cooking and for food, and I tied that passion back to those moments cooking with my grandmother when like life was okay, and when food was having a positive influence on me from a young age. And then growing up, I mean, I loved to eat. I loved to try new things. I loved understanding new flavors. And so when I was around Donna and Seth, I really let my guard down and I became myself. You know, I'm a loving person. I have a good sense of humor. I care about people and I care about things a lot. And that was just not who I was to everybody else. I had some big chip on my shoulder that I couldn't shake. But around Donna and Seth, I think they saw the real Alon, like the person that was inside. And they took that opportunity to like do what they could to help me and go out of their way to help me.
Yeah. I'm so surprised to hear that about your past based on your, I mean, we've only just met, but based on your demeanor and just your vibe and your attitude, you seem like such a happy-go-lucky guy.
Oh, I mean,
so
I
things
am.
Have, things
I mean,
have changed so much over the years, but
I'm nothing like I was.
Yeah. And so is there times when you look back and think, like, who was that person? Does it still feel like that was very much a part of you and you've evolved? Or do you think that there was almost like a split and you've become sort of like a totally new person in a way?
Well, going to culinary school helped me wipe the slate clean. And it was, I describe it as being a painter and getting a huge blank canvas with nothing on it.
And this was at the CIA?
At
that
the
you
CIA,
went?
Yeah.
In New York?
Upstate New York.
Okay,
yep.
At Hyde Park.
Yep.
Okay, cool.
So I remember my first day in culinary school, just walking down the hallway and seeing that people were making eye contact with me, you know, saying hello, introducing themselves to me. And, you know, in my high school, that didn't happen. The teachers all hated me for the most part, except for Donna. So, you know, they had all written me off. And so I started to feel in culinary school, like, this is really my second chance. Like, here I am, like, I'm leaving this, like, single IKEA bed that I've been sleeping on for, 15 years. And, next thing you know, I'm in a dorm and my window is overlooking the Hudson River and it's fall and the trees are changing color. And I'm meeting people and going to these orientations where people are treating me like a normal person. I didn't hang out with normal people. I didn't have like normal friends where we like shared feelings and stuff in high school. That was never, you know, it was all my friendships were based around getting in, getting into trouble and doing things that were not okay. And so I started to like meet people that were like just interested in like me and what I liked about cooking and where I came from. And my life just turned around. I mean, it was pretty much that instant. I still had to shake off some of like the bad tendencies of like how to handle conflict. You know, I got in trouble for slicing some guy's tires open in the parking lot because he was being an asshole to me. And, you know, I'd get into a fight every once in a while in the kitchen with, you know, someone that was getting up in my face or challenging me somehow. But that's not, I never, at that time, it definitely didn't feel comfortable to do that. And it definitely felt like I was risking something and that there was consequence. And I didn't want to give up this opportunity that I had to really start fresh. So, I graduated the CIA with perfect attendance and, I won an award from Robert Mondavi during the graduation ceremony. And I got pretty much straight A's and graduated close to the top of my class. And so it turned me like that. It just did. And from then on, I never looked back and I've, you know, I kept my head down and I worked and studied and, I worked a lot and my, all of my 20s and early 30s just kind of went by in a flash.
Were you able to kind of funnel your anger and shift it into intensity? Or like, did you carry some of that anger with you as like a chip on your shoulder to be like, now I need to be successful because I've sort of committed to this career path? Like some chefs have a sort of an obsessive nature and some have just a sort of a wonder and they approach everything with just searching for flavor and trying new things. Are you one or the two or somewhere in the middle?
I don't know that I would categorize myself in one of those two things. Mm-hmm. I think I loved what I did. I loved being in kitchens. I loved the camaraderie of it. I loved studying about food and cooking things and being challenged. I loved the intensity of the kitchen and of the line. And honestly, a lot of the things that I saw coming up in the industry were, you know, just as bad as the shit that I was doing in high school and, you know, chefs cursing at me and throwing stuff at me and, you know, doing drugs openly and all
the kitchen,
of
the kitchen of the 90s.
The kitchen
wasn't
of
quite
the 90s and
much different
early
from
2000s.
What, yeah, yeah.
And so I had a lot of really bad leaders. Like I think because I didn't have a lot of great influences as a child, like coming up, other than Donna and Seth, but I was like 16 years old at that time. I felt myself kind of gravitating towards, these asshole chefs and thinking that that was okay or thinking that that was cool and that you needed to be like a narcissistic, condescending piece of shit to be successful in the restaurant business. And, as I got older and in my early 30s, I started, you know, I met my wife, Emily, and she helped to really change my life around to help me understand that I'm somebody that is okay for me to be like who I am and that I can, I don't need to like go towards negativity just because that's what I was used to. You know, I think that it's been an evolution and my life has continued to evolve. And I think just in the last few years, I've finally been able to surround myself with people that I can actually really look up to and people that I trust and that are just good intentioned, honest, good-hearted people. And I'm 41 and I feel like the last 3 years of my life has been the happiest three years of my life.
We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk more about you getting out of CIA and of course, starting on your culinary journey to where you are today. Stick with us. We'll be right back here on The Line on Heritage Radio.
This episode is brought to you by the Michigan Cherry Committee. A cherry isn't just a cherry. When it comes to tart cherries, the wonderfully U.S.-grown Montmorency tart cherry variety is the cherry with more. They're available year-round, dried, frozen, canned, juice, and concentrate. U.S. Montmorency tart cherries are also one of America's superfruit, which means they're good for you. Tart cherries contain many antioxidants and beneficial phytonutrients, including anthocyanins, the pigments that give tart cherries their bright red color. And don't forget about flavor. U.S. Montmorency's unique sour-sweet profile make them an excellent addition to yogurt, oatmeal, salads, trail mix, and of course, a classic cherry pie. Learn more about the wonderfully U.S.-grown Montmorency tart cherry at choosecherries.com.
Welcome back to The Line. I'm your host, Eli Sussman. I'm joined today by Chef Alon Shaya. We were talking before the break about you getting into the CIA and how you really thrived there and how you connected with someone in your high school, Donna, who really changed the trajectory of where you were going. So when you graduate the CIA with honors, you're really starting to sort of make a true path for yourself. What was the next thing that you did? Did you go work at a restaurant in New York or did you go to New Orleans? What was your next step?
I went to Las Vegas and I worked in Vegas as a cook in the casinos and quickly started to get promoted up into sous chef. And by the time I was 20 years old, I was running the Rio Seco Golf Club, which was the golf resort for the Rio Casino. And I was running this kitchen. I mean, we would serve 12 people a day, but I was throughout this time learning a lot of communication skills the hard way and learning how to like work with people and understand how to properly communicate my thoughts and how to listen to people. So definitely not an easy path, and definitely not, I was definitely chasing the paycheck at a young age, even though I loved the food. I found myself by the time I was 23 years old running a buffet at the Harrah's Casino in St. Louis. I moved from Vegas to St. Louis, but I kept getting promoted. And they were putting me into these positions that I shouldn't have been in at that time of my life.
Why do you say that you shouldn't have been in those positions?
I just wasn't ready to lead people.
Just maturity level.
Yeah, I wasn't mature enough to lead people the right way. Mm-hmm. I didn't communicate well. I tried to emulate the crazy asshole chef that was training me that I thought was cool. It just took years and years of that, those types of like hard lessons to finally get me to like understand that there's such a much better way that makes me so much happier to do, and that I don't need to keep gravitating towards like the hard, like the resist, like the way of most resistance, that there were easier ways to excel. And that had to be with me really understanding how to communicate and how to respect people and how to listen to people.
When you move up too quickly, you always run the risk of not having someone above you who can be your mentor. And then you don't necessarily know how to solve a problem and you have no one to go to. So you just have to kind of fake it.
Yeah.
And it can be a very lonely place, right? Where you're 23 or 24, you're in charge, but really you're still kind of lost how to go about the day to day. Was there someone that you were able to connect with in your mid 20s who ended up being a mentor, or were you still just kind of flying solo for many years, figuring out your own path?
Yeah. I had mentors that I worked with at Harrah's, that people that were just like on the executive level that would help to guide me with advice. I wasn't good at listening to people's advice. And, you know, now knowing what I know as a 41-year-old that is focused on creating a company with a really safe and healthy work environment as being my number one priority for my profession right now. I didn't have a mentor that really taught me things other than, I would say, Donna and Seth were my two biggest influences. And then coming up, I've really just kind of had to figure it out.
How did you end up in New Orleans? And, you know, you spent a lot of time in BRG and had a lot of success there. How did you end up starting with that group? And you rose again quite quickly with that organization as well.
Yeah. I don't consider myself really having a lot of success there.
Okay.
I feel that I definitely moved up the ranks. I definitely, like, you know, I moved to Italy when I was right after Hurricane Katrina, where I started to really begin my understanding of self-reflection and trying to really dig down to who I was. And then, you know, I felt that I needed to move to Italy to learn how to cook Italian food. Like, I wasn't ready at that point. To answer your question, I moved from St. Louis to New Orleans in 2003 as a transfer with Harrah's. So I came down as the buffet chef from Harrah's in St. Louis to be the buffet chef at Harrah's in New Orleans. And again, chasing that paycheck, I was making more money than my parents had ever made already, like way above that. And it wasn't that much money, but I felt at the time like I could afford my own car payment and I could afford a apartment. And then eventually a condo that I bought. I thought that I was like rich, like very rich. And, with working at the casino, it provided me with those benefits, and a higher paycheck than I would have gotten at an independent restaurant. And then Katrina hit, and I decided to move to Italy to apprentice out there. And Jeff Michoud, who is a chef in Philadelphia at Osteria, was my connection to get me a job in Italy. I moved there and began working in Salumifici, which are like the butcher shops where culatello and salami and pancetta are made. And I worked in a ristorante where I would roll pasta and bake bread and work the risotto station. And that really helped to solidify my love and passion for Italian cooking and culture. I came back and moved in with Emily and I had met just about 6 months prior to me moving to Italy. And she would come out and visit me while I was out there. And when I came back, I moved in with her. And I began the planning for opening Domenica.
And you took all those things that you had been studying overseas and brought them back to Domenica. Did you have expectations that Domenica would be as well received as it did? Did you have an inkling in your mind that it would, garner you significant acclaim?
Well, I guess I hoped that it would. I was definitely fighting for success. I was fighting for, you know, the recognition in magazines or being invited to come to a food festival to cook or being interviewed on the morning news for my Passover menu or whatever it might have been. I enjoyed that. I enjoyed feeling like my work was being appreciated. And so then as that was happening and I was getting a chance to really like know the customers and build relationships with people in New Orleans and feel like I was really putting down some roots as a citizen of New Orleans. And that meant a lot to me because I was there through Katrina and I saw New Orleans just collapse. And I felt, like I could be useful there. I felt like I could make a difference there. So seeing New Orleans kind of come back after the storm was one of the most powerful moments of my life. And I think really influenced me to, care about being part of a bigger community and get out and to do things to help the community. So I've spent most of my, I guess I've spent the last 15 years like really going out of my way to do things that I can for the community as a whole, and especially for students that are studying food in high school. And that's always made me feel just really, really good.
Shio was such a personal project. Obviously, it carried your name, and you started serving food there that was closely aligned with your family's history. Were you nervous in any way to start cooking that food? There's almost like more of a microscope sometimes when you're cooking, quote unquote, your own food, and expectations can often be higher in that scenario. How did you feel when you were R&Ding that restaurant? And as it opened, obviously it did very well. And, you know, you won an award for it at the beginning. Were you happy in Shia in that environment at the beginning?
No, I was not happy. It was actually, I would say, probably one of the most miserable times of my life. And it was because when I was about 35, I took a trip. I took a trip to Israel, and it really clicked for me that I should be looking back towards my roots, and that I felt as an adult, way more confident in who I was and who I should be, where my roots were. And so I began to really look back at all my notes that I was taking from my Safta and all the food that she would cook for me and that my mother would cook for me. And I began cooking that food at home, and I began cooking it at Dominica and kind of like dressing it up like Italian food. You know, I would make hummus and call it cechi puree. And that I kept sneaking all these things into the menu, and I kept people seem to really like it. So I started to kind of build this confidence to say like, hey, I can be Alon Shia. I don't have to be Alon Shia, the really scared kid in Philadelphia. I can really start to think about who I am and where my life is going and what values are very important to me. And I never, I never put value on like personal values as a young adult in high school. My value was work ethic and passion for food. Those were the two things that meant the most to me. And once I started getting older, I realized that, I really liked good communication. I liked respect. I liked empowerment, that those things were important to me. And it was important that I was that way to other people. If these were the things that I was expecting the way that people should treat me. And I never felt that like during the Shia years. I felt like it was completely unsustainable, and I felt like the path that I was on was eventually just going to hit a brick wall, and it did.
And when all that happened, and there was, I guess it was forced upon you, right? You had to go in a new direction, and you're kind of, there's a blank slate or a new road in front of you.
Yeah.
Was there ever a question that you were going to do a different type of cuisine, or did you say to yourself, I'm going to stay in this Israeli realm, these flavors that like I'm so passionate about and that I've been cultivating and developing? Or did any part of you say, that was so painful, that was so tumultuous, maybe I need to move away from that for a specific amount of time or for forever?
My goal, once hitting that wall, was to create a safe and healthy work environment for a team of people. And my goal was to create a set of core values that we would be able to build a company on. And my wife, Emily, and I began working on that together. And in 2017, we started Pomegranate Hospitality, just her and I in our living room with no restaurants and no employees. And we began building the blueprint for how Pomegranate Hospitality's mission statement and how the mission statement would build the path forward for us as a restaurant group. We didn't know what restaurants we were going to have. We didn't have any idea what the next restaurant was going to be, where it was going to be. Like, we worked on getting an understanding of what Pomegranate Hospitality was going to be. And then we started to, you know, bring people on board. I hired about six people that we all worked out of my living room with my wife and our two dogs, and our director of people and culture, Susie Dare, was one of the first hires that we made, along with Zach Engel, who now has a restaurant in Chicago, Galit, that is really incredible. And Zach came on as our culinary director, and Meredith Dunbar came on as our communications director, and she was working with me at Shia, and a couple of other people joined our team, Sean, who was running operations for us. And together we all created the core value system. Also Kara Peterson, who's our head chef at Saba, who I worked with at Shia, came and joined our team. And so we all together sat and we said, okay, well, what are the values that we want this company to be about? And we settled on 9 core values that really run the show for us. And our interview questions for recruits are built on the 9 core values. Our exit interview on your last day of employment is built off of questions from the 9 core values. When we sit and talk about performance and evaluations, we ask about empowerment, and we ask about respect and fairness and communication. There's one question, or there's one line on the evaluation form that has to do with customers. And so our focus now that we have 2 restaurants, Saba in New Orleans and Safta in Denver, and a consulting company that we work on consulting with other businesses. And we have a foundation now called the Shia Barnett Foundation that I work with. I'm so lucky enough to be able to work with Donna Barnett and Seth Schramm, the 2 teachers that helped to pave that original road out of Philly for me. The 3 of us, plus the rest of our team, all work together to create experiences for children in career and technical sciences at the high school level, to help them find their paths forward the way that they did for me. And so I would say, since we started Pomegranate and put our value system in place, not only for our company, but also personally for our lives, it's been the happiest time of my life.
Yeah. I'm curious about just general mental health, because that's one of the main tenets that a hospitality group can tackle maybe more efficiently than a singular restaurant, right? Like, part of the reason you build that infrastructure is so when you look back at what was a toxic environment and you exit that, you can create a framework for your employees to have a safe existence, right? And when you're putting all those pieces together, and you're putting those 9 core values and you're just sitting in that room together, did you feel at that moment like all the weight from everything that happened had been lifted off your shoulders?
100%. I mean, I felt that I was surrounded with people that shared in the same values, because we built them together. And no matter what you personally think or what your personal values are, if you are surrounded by people that don't share that, you have a very hard road ahead of you. And there's probably a lot of times that you're going to fail at a lot of things because you don't have the support system around you that is needed to reinforce those values. And so if you're responsible for the jobs of 170 people, which, you know, my wife Emily and I now are, it becomes very important to say, like, these are the non-negotiables. This is the way we're going to act. This is the way we're going to expect people to act. and we have control over who we surround ourselves with to say, do you believe in these things? And is this something you're going to commit to? And we ask every member of Pomegranate Hospitality to commit to those values. And when they don't, they're held accountable. And it has been incredible to see because we did a very good job in articulating the tone of what our company was going to be about. It has grown from within, and the people that we work with every day are holding us accountable and holding each other accountable to following those values. And so it's bigger than me or Emily. It's now something that's alive in a whole big group of people, and that living organism now is feeding itself through people that share in respect and empowerment, and they don't put up with bullshit, and you know they'll call you out on it if something is not right and if we're not living up to our promises. And I'll tell you what, there's no utopia. It's not all happy, great, everything's good every day. Like, we deal with a lot of hard decisions, and we deal with a lot of things that make us stay up at night sometimes. And it has to do, though, with us feeling confident that the decisions we're going to make as a group will tie back to the core values of our company. And that kind of helps to be our lighthouse as we do grow our company. We don't do everything great, but we have intentions too, and we work towards it. And I feel like there's no one on our team that is intentionally pulling it down the way that I've always kind of felt before.
I have a question about money and fundraising, but it's kind of twofold. And the first part of it is, you know, when you're putting together this Pomegranate Hospitality, this new team, and you have these people that have these specific roles, in order to obtain and retain quality talent and also to open up restaurants, the fact of the matter is you just need money to do it, right?
Yes, you do.
And a lot of the things that you're articulating are important to you and your wife and your business. They are things that they cost additional money.
For sure.
Right? And they don't necessarily hit the bottom line or appear as a line item in a traditional sense of the word, right? Sometimes doing a good job at being a business person means you have to make a little bit of less money to make people happier, right?
Yeah.
So I guess my main question is like, did you bring on a financial partner in order to help open Pomegranate Hospitality? And did you find it difficult while articulating all those things to connect with the right person who saw your vision as well?
You can say the same thing about an heirloom tomato, that you spend more money for an heirloom tomato to be able to provide a delicious tasting tomato to your guest. You're not going to make the margin on an heirloom tomato that you would make on a canned tomato or on a, you know, 5x6 underripe grocery store tomato. And so it takes investment, and it takes surrounding yourself with people that believe in that the investment to pay extra for that heirloom tomato is important enough for the success of the business. If you switch out the words heirloom tomato with people and culture, it's the exact same thing. You have to find the people that will invest in you, but also invest in the ideology that the restaurant business doesn't have to be a toxic work environment, and that we should offer health benefits, and that we should offer paid time off, and that we should offer yearly cost of living increases to keep up with inflation, and that we should offer discounts to gym memberships and an employee assistance program so our team can get help with legal or financial or mental health challenges that they may be having. The cost of going on field trips and feeding the team on a farm where our lamb are grown in Colorado costs money. And you have to, as you find investors that will help support your company to become successful, you have to find an investor that values that just as much as they do an heirloom tomato.
You have Saba and Safta. They're not in the same city. A lot of people would say that opening up a restaurant is the hardest thing that you could ever do, pretty much. And trying to manage two restaurants in the same city is incredibly difficult. But you have spots that are a plane ride away, one in Denver and one in New Orleans. Can you just briefly talk about some of the challenges that have existed
Sure.
in that type of relationship, and also how your organization has been successful in overcoming some of those challenges when you have two restaurants that are 1,000 or more miles apart?
Yeah, well, we've invested in our team, and we brought on a director of operations. Her name is Amanda Quintal. She has been just an amazing, amazing addition to our great team, and has brought such great expertise in operations. She worked for Shake Shack for a while and also for Flywheel for a while. And she has really helped Emily and I develop the processes that make operating restaurants in two different cities possible. The way we communicate, the way that we schedule meetings, the way that we split our time, it's all very calculated, and there are definite challenges with it. It's challenging to not know who a new employee is, because they started when, you know, you weren't in the same city. And so every time I go to Safta, you know, I'm meeting new people that are joining the team. And for me, that's challenging to like not be there at the whole, you know, throughout that entire, experience for them onboarding onto Pomegranate. But you know, we put a lot of trust into people that are really good at what they do, and they're the ones that set the tone on the ground. And Pomegranate Hospitality, our job is to just guide and advise the teams at the restaurants to make sure that we're treating people with respect and empowering people and staying organized and communicating well, and providing good educational opportunities and treating people fair. And all of these are our core values. And so I think that core value system really helps us to align our priorities. And then personal happiness, I think, is also very important, and work-life balance. And Emily and I really love Colorado. We love to fly fish. We love to ski. We love to be in the mountains with our dogs. And so our happiness means something to us, and part of the reason that we have a restaurant in Colorado and a restaurant in Louisiana is so that we can split our time in a it's never like an exact, you know, there, it's not 50-50, it's not 70-30, it changes all the time, but it gives us an opportunity to be somewhere we really love. We love New Orleans, we love the Rocky Mountains and Denver, and it helps keep us happy. And so I think that means something, because that's what we expect from all of our team members, that they find happiness and find balance in their lives too.
Building on that happiness for you and your wife and your business and your team, I want to close with this question, which is, as you invest so much time and energy in yourself and your business and all of these people, what is your 5-year or 10-year plan look like? How sketched out is it in your mind and actually on paper, so that all of these things that you're building, so that they can thrive and survive, but also so that you can perhaps expand and continue to grow people within your own business?
Sure.
How do you plan for that, if you can, and if you can share a little bit of what that roadmap looks like?
Yeah, well, we really started focusing on consulting, and we're working with Marriott Hotels in Atlanta right now, two different Marriotts, to develop an Italian restaurant in Atlanta. And so our team is able to grow in that sense. We've been able to get our team members to help with that consulting and that expansion from a business side. We enjoy that kind of growth because we don't have to take out any personal financial liability or go look for money. And it's good income for our company, and we get to help an operator reach their goals. And so that's something that we're doing a lot of, and we're also focusing on catering at both restaurants and growing the catering businesses. We have a catering director at each restaurant that are out trying to, you know, find parties for us to cook for and to serve at. And that's plenty for us. And every time, I mean, if my life was built on 5-year plans, you know, I don't know where I would be. Sometimes they're not even 1-month plans, but I think our goal in the next 5 years, the next 10 years is to, my dream would be in 5 or 10 years to look back and to say that our company is healthier than ever, that Saba and Safta are still great places for people to work and to live out their personal and professional dreams and goals. And that would be very successful for me.
Chef, thanks so much for being here and sharing your story. We really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you very much, Eli.
Everyone, thanks for listening to this episode of The Line here on Heritage Radio Network. You can find this episode and all of our other episodes on the website heritageradionetwork.org or wherever you get your podcasts, iTunes, Stitcher, and of course on Spotify. Join us Tuesdays at 11 a.m. for new episodes of The Line here on Heritage Radio.
The Line is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners just like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.